Welcome, welcome, everyone, to the Hockey Think Tank podcast. It's brought to you by the hockeythinktank.com website for a little bit of education, a little bit of inspiration about hockey. If you love the sport of hockey, I think you'll enjoy the website. And if you haven't gotten there, check it out. Again, lots of blogs, lots of videos. We're doing webinars now. And if you want to get a little bit more educated about the game, want to know a little bit more, I think you'll love the site. So in today's podcast episode, we chat with a living legend, one of the most successful coaches in college hockey history, George Gwozdecki. And in doing a little bit of research about him, I found a stat that's absolutely unbelievable. So Coach Gwozdecki is the only person ever to win a national championship as a player. He did that at Wisconsin, won a national championship as an assistant coach at Michigan State, won a national championship as a head coach at the University of Denver, and then also coached in the Stanley Cup Finals. He did that a couple years ago with the Tampa Bay Lightning. So not a bad resume, and we're really excited to have him on the pod. But first, want to introduce my partner, Jeff LaVecchio. Jeff, what's shaking today?
Not much, Toski. Pretty excited to have a person of Coach Gwozdecki's caliber on the show. It's very exciting for both of us. I know we had a great time talking to him. It was really cool getting to hear some of his insights on how he recruited players, not just from the guys who are scoring the goals and the guys, you know, putting up points that are fancy, but the little things that he's looking for when he was a D1 head coach or a D1 assistant coach recruiting those players. It's pretty cool to hear, you know, kind of behind the curtain. So if you're a player looking to get scouted, looking to get recruited, it's interesting to hear the small intangible things that he was looking for.
Yeah, he's got so many good stories about some of those things. And just hearing him talk about who's now the head coach at Rod Brind'Amour, Coach Gwoz, he recruited him to Michigan State way back in the day. I mean, that was, if there's any kid watching, that's something I'd have on repeat. just hearing him talk about what they call Rod the Bod now. But yeah, I mean, he's obviously had so many experiences in the game, and his insight is unbelievable. So it was a great conversation, and for anybody that's going to be listening, we can't wait for you to hopefully learn as much as we did. So without further ado, let's take it over to Coach George Gwozdecki. Really excited to have former Denver head coach George Gwozdecki on the podcast. He's one of the most accomplished coaches in NCAA hockey history. And so, Coach Gwozdecki, welcome to the show, and thanks for taking some time to sit here and speak with us today.
Well, Topher and Jeff, it's my pleasure. It's I've been following you guys, and you guys are doing a great job, and looking forward to continuing following as your thing continues to expand and grow forward and help educate the hockey public. I think it's a great thing you're doing.
Awesome. Thanks so much. And so let's take it to where it all began. You grew up in Thunder Bay, Ontario, which is a hockey hotbed. What was it like growing up in Thunder Bay, and how did you get down to play at the University of Wisconsin for college?
Oh, boy. I'm going to try to capsulize this as much as I can. And I'm sure that if any of our players know that it's tough for me to capsulize it. So certainly Thunder Bay being a climate that is very conducive to outdoor ice. And so as a three-year-old, I started skating. And like a lot of Canadian kids, started playing hockey probably about a year later. Grew up playing my youth hockey in what was at the time, Thunder Bay was divided into two different cities. It was Port Arthur and Fort William. They were divided by an imaginary line, so to speak. But played with, you know, through my youth hockey and into my bantam midget years and finally into my junior years in Thunder Bay, played with some famous players, not only from the Thunder Bay area, but who went on to play not only either collegiately or play professional. Lee Fogelin, who was the captain of the Edmonton Oilers, and Dennis Oucher, who went on to play the Pittsburgh Penguins, and Tom Mullany, who went on to star at University of Minnesota Duluth for a number of years. Maybe one of the most famous guys on our team at the time was a guy by the name of Bill Goldthorpe, who was known as Goldie Goldthorpe, and whose character was depicted in the movie Slapshot as Ogie Goldthorpe.
I was going to say, it sounds very familiar.
Yeah, we had quite a crew. We might have been one of the toughest teams in Canada at the time, and I was very fortunate because I was a third, fourth line player. But because of the, you know, because of how strong our team was and successful our team was, everybody, including yours truly, got exposure to the scouts, the junior scouts, and the collegiate scouts, and the NHL scouts. And so that was how I first got my opportunity to be able to talk with some assistant coaches and head coaches who were coaching south of the border in the United States. I didn't know anything about NCAA hockey at all. But that was my first, my opportunity to be able to play for this team, the Thunder Bay Vulcans, was a real great opportunity for me to get exposed to some collegiate programs. And I was a very average player. I decided after talking and visiting a couple of campuses that Wisconsin was the place that I wanted to go to school and to play hockey at. And Bob Johnson was my coach at the time. And I was a walk-on. So it was, that was the start of, or maybe I should say it was probably nearing the end of my playing career and my start of my coaching career in my latter stages of my eligibility at Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's great. And you won a national championship at Wisconsin. And what was it like to play for Badger Bob Johnson? I grew up right outside of Chicago, and Wisconsin was one of the closest schools to us. So I had kind of grown up knowing about him and learning about him. What was he like to play for? And was he somebody that kind of got your fire lit to get into coaching when you were done playing?
First of all, he was, I'm sure everybody who has ever played for Bob, whether it was the collegiate level, high school level, the professional level, has different words to describe him, different ways to describe him. But I think everybody would agree they loved playing for him. He was extremely enthusiastic, very ingenious, very, he loved the game. He had fun with it. He was a great recruiter, so he always had great talent that he could work with, and he knew how to motivate that talent and encourage that talent to get better. And, you know, he was just, as a very limited hockey player, I had a chance to watch him work with some great players at the collegiate level at the time that were on our team, Craig Norwich and Mark Johnson, Bob's son, Mike Eaves and Steve Alley and Johnny Taft. In fact, those five guys made up one of the most successful power play units in NCAA history. In 1977, that group of five guys was incredible. They hit on 41% of power plays that they had all year long. And so it was, teams were just absolutely afraid to death of taking a penalty against Wisconsin in those days. So, but I had plenty of time to watch that evolve because, you know, I was not a power play guy, although maybe I think I might have thought I was. But
everyone
I had
does.
Plenty of chance. Yeah, exactly. I had plenty of chances to watch and how Bob worked with them, and he always made games within games. You know, he was, you know, I remember playing little games, end zone games, cross ice games. He was extremely innovative for his time, and he loved the game. We were on the ice 7 days a week, Sundays, even though we didn't have an organized practice. He would always have these pickup scrimmage games that he loved to participate in, to play in, and he'd call them the Russian games. And he loved the Russian, the Soviet Union powerful teams at the time were really, reinventing how the game was played. And he loved that. And he was a sponge to learn that. He and Herb Brooks were bitter enemies. I mean, they really despised each
really?
Other. And, oh, they despised each other. And they competed. I mean, when the two teams, when Minnesota, Wisconsin would get together, it was like something I had never seen. Even playing in junior hockey back in Thunder Bay, I had never seen the intensity and the ferociousness of how these teams went after each other. And back in those days, we had, you know, those noon lunches on Friday, the luncheons that the host team would host and bring the visiting coach in to talk about the series, and those things would be packed with hundreds of people who just couldn't get enough of the rivalry and hearing about what was to come on Friday and Saturday night. So, yeah, it was playing for Bob was a great experience. It whet my appetite, as you said, it whet my appetite for coaching. Even though I really didn't understand, you know, I didn't have, Bob was the first one to say, hey, you ever thought about coaching? You know, when I was starting to, my career was starting to unwind or come to an end at Wisconsin, you know, he was the guy that first put it into my head. And I said, yeah, this is, yeah, I think maybe I'd like to do that. I mean, you know, Bob has made it so much fun and I've learned so much from him, but you know, coaching would probably be pretty easy for me. Well, you know, again, that's how naive I was, but you know, that's really where it all started.
So just to touch on something you just brought up about him, you said he was a great motivator. Can you expand on that? Like, what do you mean by that? Was he more of motivating each individual with different pressure points for what worked for them or as a team as a whole? Or what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, as I said, he would do a lot of playing games within games. He loved golf. He was an avid golfer, and I remember one time he came in and he used the analogy of playing a round of golf, comparing our hockey season to a round of golf, and as corny as this might sound, it was something that the guys, you know, picked up on, and we always would mock him about it a little bit and tease him about it a little bit and tease each other but you know I think how he scored our season was okay. If we won a game at home, it was a par, and if we won a game on the road, it was a birdie, and if we lost a game at home, it was a bogey. And all, so he would keep score on our big board in the locker room as to, you know, what score we had of our round going on, and so it were little things like that that he always introduced to make it more fun, to get your mind off of the actual game and get it on something that you know, was, as I said before, fun and at times just a little bit corny, but he had all kinds of little things that he would love to do, and you know, he would always compare our players to some of the better NHL players or some of the great Soviet players of the time. And you know, you compare, you know, Steve Alley to this person or that person and in front of the team, which made, you know, certainly made guys want to be, you know, I want to be compared to somebody, an NHL coach. What do I have to do? And so you'd go out and work hard, and then on the day where he'd pick you and frame you as a guy that in the NHL who he that you remind him of, that was always a great blessing that he would give you. So it was a lot of fun. The one year that I was there that Bob did not coach our team was the year that he was coaching the Olympic team. And it was, I believe, 76 when the Olympics were in the Winter Olympics were in Innsbruck, Austria. And so Bob took a year sabbatical from his coaching position at Wisconsin to coach the team, the Olympic team. And he brought on his staff, Grant Stanbrook, who was the head coach at Dartmouth at the time. And that was a very difficult... A really difficult year and a topsy-turvy year for the Wisconsin hockey program because we had a lot of talent, but without Bob's leadership, things were just fell apart. And I believe we got knocked out in the first round of the WCHA playoffs. And then Bob comes back after the Olympics, and that next year we ran off. We won the national title. That would be in the 77, and we set all kinds of records, and it was that's how much Bob meant to the program. I mean, he was the guy who really established it and made it a powerhouse, knew a great recruiter, as I said before, and really, there are times where he could identify certain traits in people that maybe other coaches didn't see, because maybe the trait was something completely different than being a fast skater or a great stick handler or a great shooter. But Bob would always find these niches for these kinds of players, and that would really allow that player to shine in the lineup and for the team, and bring that team closer together and make the team even more successful.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, we're a little bit too young to really know the facets of Bob Johnson, but the one thing that all of us younger guys, we still hear today, is it's a great day for hockey every day, and that was Badger Bob's motto, and it certainly sounds like he epitomized that, and really it reflected in the way that he coached and how you guys approached coming to the rink. So that must have been a really great experience.
Well, you know, the thing that I always remember is that, you know, the hockey season, as you guys know, is long. And especially at the collegiate level, where there's expectations of not only exceeding every day in practice and in games on the weekends, but, you know, you've got school and you've got, weight room work and all that kind of stuff. And it gets fatiguing. It gets tiring. You're challenged, you know, every day with your attitude to try to get better and to try to maintain a positive attitude, when sometimes it becomes really a grind. And I remember, the dog days of the season, when you're tired and it's winter, it's cold out, and you got to go to you're in 2 days of practice, at the Christmas break, and Bob would come in like it was the very first day of practice of the season. I mean, he would be so excited.
That's really cool.
I think we all remember that, every year, that first day of practice, everybody is just so excited to start the season again. And that would be Bob. I mean, he was just one of these guys that he had that enthusiasm and that love for the game. And even when it was the, as I use the term, the dog days of the season, there was a way for him to be able to, he would always come in bubbly and excited and ready to go. And it would affect everybody else in a very positive way.
Yeah, that's great. And kind of going along with that, I have to imagine that was something that you tried to do with your teams as well. And I have a list here of players that you coached, whether it was at Michigan State as an assistant coach, Miami of Ohio, even Denver, that have gone on to not just play in the hockey world, but they're still involved. And you look at guys like Matt Oates, Eustis King, Jason Woolley, who are hockey agents. You look at Chris Bergeron, Enrico Blasi, who are head coaches now at the NCAA level. You look at Mark Boxer, who's a really high up with USA Hockey. Rod Brind'Amour, even, who's the head coach in Carolina. These guys are obviously really, really passionate about the game. They wouldn't still be doing it if they weren't. Is that something that you guys really looked at in recruiting to bring these kinds of players? Is it something that you really tried to impart on these guys when they were, with you for the years that they were with you? How do you explain the fact that so many people that you've coached are still involved in hockey?
Well, I'm going to be really honest with you. I don't know in my recruiting, at least in my earlier recruiting days, if I really knew, if I had a list of things I was looking for that I went through in my head. I mean, there were certain things that, I would watch a player or a group of players on the ice, and little things would always stand out to me. I forget who I learned this from. Maybe it was Grant Stanbrook, but, to position yourself, first of all, it's important to go watch practice. If you're recruiting a player and you want to find out more about him, it's as important to watch him in practice as it is in a game. And when you're watching these players, it's important to be able to position yourself somewhere where you can watch them not only on the ice, but when they come off the ice, not so much in practice, but in a game, what are they doing on the bench? To really watch them and those are the things that really helped me to be able to evaluate, certain players that I liked. You've listed a few of the guys that I was part of in the recruiting process, some people have asked me over the years who's my maybe not the best, but you know, the one player that I remember that I knew was going to have a long career and would still be involved in hockey, and who was that player and what kind of impact he made. And my one answer, and you've already mentioned, he's one of the guys on your list you mentioned, was Brod Brindamore. From the first day I met him, I knew that he was a special athlete, and he was as, I guess you'd call him an introvert. I mean, he was extremely quiet, extremely shy. You know, and yet, you know, in those days, you know, he was playing at Notre Dame out in Wilcox, Saskatchewan, they had a powerhouse program, just watching Rod not play, but how he carried himself. He was a leader in his residence hall. He ran one of the floors in the residence halls, and you can imagine all these boys throughout the residence halls. You know, they're you know, pretty much running wild. Every floor had a leader, and there was, I think, four floors, and three of the four floors were loud and messy, and then you'd get to Rod's floor, and it seemed like it was a study floor. It was quiet. It was neat. It was tidy. All the boys were, I mean, they were, you know, 9th, 10th, 11th graders, but they were all real men, so to speak, because they handled their responsibility like they should. And their leader on that floor was Rod Brindamore. And I knew right from that point that no matter what his, how many goals he scored or whatever, he was going to exceed and be successful no matter what level of hockey he wanted to attain. And so it doesn't surprise me at all the kind of success he had, not only in his 1 year at Michigan State, where he had a huge impact on our team, but in his long, illustrious NHL career and now as a young head coach in the National Hockey League, I don't know if I've ever been so happy and excited and really emotional when I watched Rod lift the NHL, the Stanley Cup trophy over his head that day a few years ago. That was something very special to me. And I remember kind of my wife looking at me and she's saying, "Why are you tearing up?" And I said, "Well, it's a long story, but, you know,
honey, you don't know what it's like being out in Wilcox, Saskatchewan
and that kind of journey, you know, and I don't want to downplay all those other guys who I've been blessed to work with. But, yeah, Rod was, he was a very special individual, still is. And, as I have so many of those guys that were with us at Michigan State or at Miami or at the University of Denver. Yeah, I've been very, very blessed. That's for sure.
So when you were talking about, you know, like a Rod Brindamore or somebody like that, and you said you would go and watch a practice or a game, and you weren't just looking at the goals or the assists or the plays they're making, and you're looking at them on the bench or them after a drill. Like, what separates a Rod Brindamore? Like, what are you seeing out of players that you're like, yes, this is the kind of guy I need to have? What are those little things that guys like that are doing? Because as a young coach, just recently retired, and Toph is the same way, we're always trying to preach to them, like, the little things add up to big things and body language. But from a person like you, your stature and what you've done in the game, like, what is something that you were looking at that made you go like, wow, I need this guy?
Well, Barry McKenzie was at the time was coaching at Notre Dame, and so in watching their games, you know, I would watch Rod's play on the ice, then he'd go to the bench, and Barry'd lean over and talk with him, you know, Rod's head was always nodding, like, yeah, I understand, or I get it. I couldn't hear the conversation, but you could just see that Rod's taking it in, and Barry was a tough coach. I mean, he was very demanding. And you can see, I mean, you know, you can always tell when a player really doesn't want to hear something. He turns his head or he bows his head even more. He's trying to get away or he doesn't want to hear what the coach is saying. Robert is always accepting it, nodding his head. He would be, you know, you could see him patting a teammate on the back or on the shoulders or on the helmet. You know, he was one of these guys that was, you could see he was a leader on the bench. You know, he was always encouraging. you know, he would, you could see him lean to his left or lean to his right and whisper something at, or talk to somebody, you know, before he went on the ice, on the ice before a faceoff, he would be turning and talking to a defenseman or talking to a forward before. He was always the last guy in to the faceoff. I mean, he was a guy that really directed his teammates, and there was nobody that worked harder on the ice. You could just tell about how, you know, how committed he was in those years before the phrase 200-foot player was used. He was a 200-foot player. I mean, he took as much pride in his own zone as he did in the other zone 200 feet away. And so, you know, you could really tell those things very easily by, you know, by how he conducted himself and his lack of celebration when he would score a goal, and then his celebration when his teammates would score a goal. That was such a huge selling point for me. It's like, wow. I mean, he gets more, at least externally, he gets more excitement from his teammate scoring than when he scores. It was just like, did I really see that? I remember, I mean, and I watched him again. These are the days before the four evaluation, three contact rule. And so I must've watched 12 games he played. And, you know, it was just like, you know, at first I thought maybe this isn't true. And all of a sudden I started watching this more and more. I'm thinking, this is unbelievable. I mean, I've never seen anything like this before. So, you know, again, it just further cemented what kind of individual he was and how important he was, not only to that team, but all the future teams that he'd be part of.
Yeah, that's really cool. And we used to always talk about that when I was coaching with Coach Schaefer, who's been around for a long time, and I'm sure you know very well. He would talk to us about the days when you can go out and basically spend the week with a kid and really get to know them and watch them in practice and watch them in the games and meet their families and have dinner with them and all that kind of stuff. And you really knew what you were getting when you would present an offer to a kid. And he would get, and we would get really frustrated when, you know, some of these other schools and the way that recruiting is now, you know, you see a guy go and watch a kid play for a period and then want to offer him a full scholarship. And so you got to make your decisions a lot quicker. And it's just, it really frustrated him. And just hearing you talk and listening to him talk about those kinds of things, you really get to understand why that is. And, but yeah, I wish we can get back to that day, because it's the Wild West now. And I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know already.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I don't mean to say that Rod Brindamore was this hidden gem that no one else saw. I mean, he was being recruited by every top Division I school in the United States at the time. And I remember, as quiet as he was, I really didn't think that I was able to develop the kind of relationship with him that I wanted to. And so I remember, it was probably in January, and, you know, he was getting close to make his decision, and I felt no confidence that Michigan State was the school that he was going to choose. And I remember telling that to my boss, Ron Mason. I said, you know, he's a tough nut to crack. I really don't have any clue. In fact, I'm not feeling real good about it. And then, you know, I remember one evening at my house, or at my little condo at the time, where, you know, Rod called, and I remember picking up the phone. He said, Coach Gwozdecki, this is Rod Brindamore. And I'm thinking, oh boy, here we go. he's about to tell me he's going to North Dakota, or he's about to tell me he's going to go somewhere else. And I said, hi, Rod. And he said, Coach, I want to become a Spartan.
Oh, so cool.
And I remember saying, you do? Why? You know, I was shocked, but I mean, obviously in a great way. So, I mean, that, and I don't mean to make this the Rod Brindamore hour, because I mean, there's a lot of great players that have very similar traits, but you know, that was, those memories are still very vivid to me. And, a number of years later, I remember seeing Rod, I believe we just happened to bump into each other at an airport. This is many years later, after he was already into his National Hockey League career. And, how he'd gone from being such a introvert and shy young man to all of a sudden now a guy who is confident in what he can do and talkative, and I couldn't get him to stop talking.
So, well, he's Rod the Bod now. He's Rod the Bod. I mean, that's his shtick.
he always was. He always was. In fact, we made a rule early in his career that he had to stay out of the weight room because we felt that he was going to not be ready to play on the weekends. And he would find time later on in the day after practice was over to sneak into the weight room and work out. And we finally decided, you know what, if that's what he wants to do, that's what he wants to do. But yeah, he was special. That's for sure.
I actually have heard that story. I heard that at State they had to lock him out of the weight room, but I didn't know if that was just like lore or if that was actually true.
No, we had to do that because, you know, he was such an avid athlete, where he knew he wanted to get stronger. He wanted to maintain what he had built up over the summer. He was built. I mean, he was the Bod even as a freshman at Michigan State. And, but you know, we finally realized, you know, we can put the locks on the door. He's going to find a different weight room. He's going to go over to the football building and work out there, or he'll go to the basketball building and work out there, or he'll go to the air mineral building, work out there. So for us to, keep him away from the hockey weight room is not going to keep him away from training.
Yeah.
And we figured that out about a month and a half into the season.
That's great. Well, we talked a little bit about, the recruiting side of things, and just to kind of transition, just looking at when you were a head coach at both Miami and at Denver, I look at the list of guys that have worked under you as assistants, and being in the business and knowing it, I always felt that the head coach's most important decision is who they're going to hire as their assistants. And you look down your list, you've had, Bob Motzko, who's the head coach at the University of Minnesota. Rico Blasi, head coach at Miami of Ohio. Seth Appert, who coached at RPI, now coaching the U18 team. Derek Lalonde, who's an assistant coach with Tampa Bay. Bob Pryor, head coach at Princeton a couple years ago. David Carl, who's now the assistant coach the head coach at Denver. Steve Miller, who's an associate head coach at Ohio State, who I have no idea how that guy has not been a head coach yet. He just wins wherever he goes. But just the list of guys that have coached with you and coached under you is incredible. And did you have a certain philosophy on hiring assistant coaches? What were your thoughts about hiring all these people? And, I'm sure you're not surprised to see where they all are today.
You know, I don't know if I had any real philosophy. Obviously, they had to have some type of a understanding of the game, and certainly all those guys did. But you know, the one thing that I remember about all those guys, and you know, the time periods that they were part of our staff, is that the staff was always really, really close. I mean, you know, you go through, it's a long season, and you know, whether it's during the playing season or the recruiting time of year, and you know, the staff was so close. They joked with each other. We had a ton of fun. You know, we shared struggles and frustrations together. We were, our families were best friends. We had Christmas dinners together. We had Easter dinners together. We had Thanksgiving dinners together. It was a very, very close knit group of guys and their families. And the loyalty and the trust amongst the staff was what it needs to be in order to be able to compete at that type of at that level and try to be successful. So, you know, I don't know if there's any specific thing that I was looking for from a hockey standpoint, but I certainly was looking for people that would fit into our staff, and they were all different. I mean, you know, Seth Appert and Steve Miller that were on our staff back in the days that we won the two national titles in 2004 and 2005 couldn't be more different.
And no.
as you know, because you know them both, I believe. And,
yep.
And yet how they, the strengths of each guy, was so important to our overall staff and our success, and the strengths of one guy hid the weaknesses of the other guy, and back and forth, those are things that we're very fortunate that we were able to have those kinds of people who were friends and you know, wanted to do things to help the team and the programs be successful. The idea of, okay, I've got to be, I'm an assistant here right now on this staff, but within the next 4 or 5 years, I need to be a head coach somewhere else. That never, ever was a goal of any of those guys. I mean, we loved working together, and I think, the passion for what those guys brought to the program fed itself and was transferred to the players. I'm probably as polar opposite of Bob Johnson as far as my enthusiasm and how I carry myself on a daily basis. But, Steve and Seth made up for that. And as did Derek, as did David Lassonde, as did Rico Blasi. I mean, those guys were the guys that really, kept me excited on a daily basis. And I'm just very, very fortunate and blessed, as I said before, to be able to have such great young guys and great young coaches that have been part of our staff over the years.
Yeah, that's great. And one guy in particular I wanted to ask you about, because he might be one of the funniest people I've ever met in my entire life, is Derek Lalonde, the one and only Newsy. And I remember I lived with a guy named Alex Spezia, who was being recruited to Ferris State at the time, and Newsy was the one that was recruiting him. And our rooms were right next to each other. And every time Newsy called, you knew Newsy called because Spees was laughing the entire time that he was on the phone with them. And had another guy just meeting in the business, Peter Menino, who's now an assistant coach with Miami of Ohio, talking about the process when Newsy was interviewing with you guys at Denver. What was it like coaching with him? He's now an assistant coach with John Cooper in Tampa Bay. And just tell the listeners a little bit about him. Maybe you have a funny story about him, because he's certainly a character.
Well, it's interesting you should mention Derek, because they're playing here they're playing the Avalanche tomorrow night here in Denver, and they are, I believe they're on their way. They played in Chicago a couple nights ago, so he called me. We're getting together for dinner later on this evening, and so I'm looking forward to that. Getting back, not only seeing Derek, but some of the coaches and some of the staff that I worked with a couple of years ago with the Tampa group. But, Derek is a unique individual. He's got a great gift of gab. He may not like this story very much.
Because, perfect.
but I'm going to give it to him, because this is the one that he first stepped onto our campus in the fall, and he replaced Seth Appert when Seth went to RPI. And his first recruit was a young man that was from BC that was looking at a number of schools, not only in the WCHA, but in the ECAC at the time. And I remember Cornell being one of those schools that he was extremely interested in. And so Newsy went out. It was his very first recruiting trip as a representative of DU, and he came back and after the trip and said, I think it went okay, but I just didn't get a real good feel from when I talked with the mom and the young man, and so we were kind of questioning what might have happened. And, I think Newsy wanted to do make an impact right away. And I think he may not have been himself. I think for whatever reason, because we started getting feedback from the young man's coach and the family that, what they'd experienced with Newsy was like a used car salesman. And they just didn't feel that he was not only knowledgeable enough, because he was brand new to our school, so he didn't really the statistics about our school, you know, how big the faculty was, and, you know, all the types of things that parents will ask you. And I know he was distraught when the young man decided he wanted to go to Cornell. But whenever one of the staff guys felt that Newsy was getting too big for his britches, they would tease him about being a used car salesman. And I know that was always a little bit of a sore spot with him. But he had great success from that point on. I mean, you know, he brought in some really good players for us. With Joey Colburn and some great players that made a real impact with our program over the years. But that's the one story that kind of is on the top of my head. I felt bad for him because that was his very first recruit as a DU assistant coach, and it exploded up on him. And I know that he was not feeling very good, but you just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. When he starts getting a big head, you just throw the used car salesman line at him and bring him back to reality.
We'll have to do that. But also, I mean, that's a great lesson for any young coach that's listening. It's a lesson that I learned the hard way too, is that you got to be yourself. And I tell the story all the time how, you know, a lot of the guys that I played for growing up were kind of like these strict disciplinarian, really hard on you type guys. And that's not really who I am. But when I first became a coach, that's who I tried to be, because that's what I thought successful coaches did. Those were the guys that I looked up to. And, I got called out real quick and didn't have a lot of respect in the locker room from the players that I coached. And that authenticity from a coach is everything. And Newsy's obviously a great guy and very knowledgeable and all that kind of stuff. So, I think that's something that we all learn at some point in our young coaching careers.
Well, I think we all learned something from that, whether it was myself or Steve Miller or Derek at the time, was that you got to know the product you're selling, you know, it's because, you know, the kids want to know about hockey, but the parents are the ones who want to know about the school.
Yeah.
They want to know about the graduation rates. They want to know about, the number of faculty that have their PhDs. They want to know, how many undergrads at the school, all these things where, you know, you just, you learn over the years, but when you're brand new on the staff, sometimes you just kind of take it for granted that, you know, you can maybe muddle your way through it. They saw through that he really didn't know his stuff. And so I think, you know, with him trying to maybe throw a few lines at them that they knew weren't facts, I think that's where he got that title.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned earlier that he's coaching in Tampa Bay right now and they're coming to play in Colorado. What was that transition like when you left Denver and went to go coach in the NHL? Was it a lot different than when you were coaching in college? Was it a little different? Talk to us a little bit about that transition and what you learned along the way.
In some ways it was, let me put it, it was very different for me because I'm going from being a head coach for 24 years to an assistant coach. And I don't know if I was really prepared for that in a way that would allow me to move right in. That was a challenge for me. And I think, I probably could have probably done a little bit better job right off the get go. But, you know, it was, I think we were all new there. I mean, even Coop was, in his first year as the head coach at Tampa. So we were all kind of feeling each other out, kind of trying to be able to figure out our roles. I think Coop was trying to be able to determine, you know, who to give what responsibilities to. And so, a common thread was that, you know, working with the guys on the team was, whether you're coaching the collegiate level, whether you're coaching at the pro level. I mean, you know, these guys were talented athletes, but they wanted to improve. They wanted to learn and they were hungry and they were talented and they had great attitudes. So that was something I really enjoyed and developed some really good relationships, not only with the players, but with our staff as well. I think I told someone this that, you know, I after that experience, you know, I realized that you know, I'm probably a better head coach than I am an assistant coach. And I don't know really what that means. Maybe it's just more of a comfort fit for me, but, it was an invaluable experience. I mean, it was as, you know, you go to the coaches clinics and you go to these different symposiums and you learn from coaches talking, but to be involved daily with people like John Cooper and Rick Bonus and, Franjean, the goalie coach, and Stevie Thomas, and even Steve Yzerman. I mean, it was an invaluable experience for me to, you know, having done things a certain way for 24 years as a head coach, and all of a sudden seeing things done, maybe not differently, but unique ways of going about doing the very same thing, was invaluable for me, and it kind of whet my appetite to learn more and more, and you know, the terminology, which, you know, sometimes can be very different than what you're used to. And so, you know, all of that was a really good learning experience for me. You know, I'm in the latter stages of my coaching career at the time, and I'm learning stuff that, you know, that is brand new to me, which was a lot of fun. And you know, I remember thinking to myself, I feel like I'm back in my early days of coaching. I'm making notes. I'm keeping a log of practices, of practice drills, of statements, of phrases, how we dealt with this, how we dealt with that. It was great. I mean, I really enjoyed the experience. But certainly after my 2 years, I knew that, you know, that there was something that I wanted to give back that I probably couldn't be able to do so if I was continued on that line. It was a great experience. I enjoyed it. We were treated awesome by our owner, Jeff Finnick. The players at that level are spoiled rotten, you know, and we joke about that a little bit. I mean, it's they're treated really, really well, as are the staffs. But it's a lot of work. Some of it can be extremely redundant, you know, as far as the video is concerned, but it was, you know, a great learning opportunity, a great professional development opportunity for me, and no regrets whatsoever. It was awesome.
Coming from looking at what you just said from a player standpoint, and you said, and knowing that you were, as a recruiter in your earlier days, looking at the little things that players do and body language and stuff, what would you say a couple of the attributes that you notice would separate, you know, a good college hockey player from an NHL player or a high level pro athlete? Because obviously, you know, Topher and I both played college hockey, went on to play pro, and everyone's goal is to play in the NHL. What are some of those things that you noticed from those guys in Tampa that they did that maybe guys at DU or other schools that you coached against didn't do?
Well, I mean, certainly you have to be able to have the talent to play there. You know, the skill set has to be there. I mean, as hard as we work, if you can't skate well enough, you can't handle a puck, it's going to be a real struggle. So, but aside from that, it was the dedication and the commitment to their business. You know, each guy is his own business, and, you know, you watch how they prepared for practice in the mornings, what they ate, you know, their stretching, their time, their dedication to their craft of how they're learning and watching video. You know, some of those guys played college hockey. Others played major junior hockey. Others were from Europe and played kind of professional hockey in Europe. But, you know, from my vantage point, I was always so impressed with how intelligent these guys were. I mean, if they had played hockey for us at DU or at Miami or at Michigan State, they would have been, you know, 3.5 to 4-point students. They were so committed and dedicated, and they had the IQ to be able to be successful if they had gone the collegiate route. So, you know, those were the things that really impressed me about those young guys. And, you know, obviously I had a very small sample. I only worked with, you know, 2 years at Tampa with the same group of players. But, you know, that was my takeaway, that, you know, these guys are so dedicated to their craft. They're so committed, their training, you know, how they went about their business in order to be able to make sure that their business was successful.
Who did you like? I'm going to put you on the spot. What age did you like coaching more? NHL guys or level, I should say, NHL or college players?
Gee, boy, that's I guess just because I spent more time at the collegiate level, I would probably lean towards the collegiate side of things because you had a little bit more opportunity to be able to be impactful in their lives, not only as hockey players, but as people, and to be able to help them mature and help them develop a more mature attitude towards life. Once you get to the professional level, you don't see these guys as much. You don't have as much, at least I never felt you had as much, you could impact them as much as you could. The collegiate player, these guys are coming in as, 18-year-old, 19-year-old freshmen, they think they're pretty good hockey players until they step on campus and all of a sudden they realize that they are at the bottom of the totem pole for the most part. They're the bottom feeders, at least as freshmen. They're the catfish and they are learning by trial and error and you can help them probably a lot more than you can help the young guys at the professional level. Not all, but maybe in general, that's more how I felt about it. And so, yeah, I would say the collegiate level.
That's great. And, Coach, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on and speak with us today. The last thing that we wanted to ask you is now you're back in Colorado and you're coaching at Valor Christian High School. What's that experience been like? You've been a lot of different places, had a lot of great success. What's it like kind of giving back to the youth now, and how much are you enjoying being back in Colorado?
I'm having a blast. I remember... where the school that I'm working at is about an 8-minute drive by car from my house. So it's very close, but in all those years working at DU, and we lived in the same house all those years, and we still live in the same house up until 3 years ago, I didn't even know this school had hockey. I knew they had a very successful football program and had become a state power in football, but I didn't even know the hockey existed here. And then when I came on board or started finding out about it, I realized kind of why that was the case. We've been making improvement. We're getting more competitive. We lost in the state championship game last year at the Pepsi Center in front of 4,000 people. So, high school hockey in the state of Colorado was really making some great inroads. It's getting better and better and better. More and more kids who have been playing at the AAA level in Colorado are deciding, I can play high school hockey and still achieve my dreams of playing junior hockey and college hockey. So, it's really fun to be part of this explosion of high school hockey in the state of Colorado right now. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm having a blast, as I said before.
Do you give your team now at the high school level the Bruce Springsteen speech? Because I talked to Paulie Staz in the last week, and he told me to make sure I asked about the Bruce Springsteen speech you gave every year.
Oh my gosh. These guys, the one thing that so many of our former players remind me of things I don't remember, but I do remember the Bruce Springsteen speech. These guys, I don't think these kids would understand it. I whether it's Stassi, Menino or any of those guys, we always joke about that, or they always tease me about that. The whole Springsteen thing came about, the difference between being good and being great. I use using Springsteen as an example. And when I saw him, when I was a student athlete at the University of Wisconsin, I was brought to a concert by somebody I had never heard of, and it just happened to be Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. And this is in 1975. And the concert was, I was an automatic, absolutely instantaneous fan after that concert in front of 2,000 people at the Dane County Coliseum. And it was just, he put on a show that I was just in awe of. And I remember 35 years later going to my only other opportunity to watch Bruce Springsteen now at the Pepsi Center in Denver, and putting on with the same energy, the same passion, the same work ethic, you know, a 4-hour long concert where he never leaves the stage, even though he lets his band leave the stage. I mean, to me, you know, you can question his song types and his music, whatever, but you can't question his passion. And the reason he's become great is because he's so dedicated to his craft. And, you know, so that's the point of my story. It went a lot longer than that, and it probably bored them to tears. But, you know, it's funny how they recall some of those things that I wasn't sure if that it would have any impact at all. I don't know if we won that game or not, but I remember the it's a vivid memory of me going to watch Springsteen, you know, first time and the second time, that's for sure.
Well, that's great. And yeah, you never know the impact sometimes you're making at any time when you're a coach. And you've obviously had a huge influence on a lot of different people at a lot of different levels, and have grown the game, not just in the state of Colorado, but NCAA hockey as a whole. And we can't tell you how much we appreciate you taking some time to sit down and talk with us today. I think for the people that are listening, especially the kids that get to hear the stories about, you know, Rod Brind'Amour and some of the other things that you're talking about, it's going to be a huge benefit to them. So thanks so much, Coach, for coming on, and we wish you the best of luck for the rest of this season.
Well, thank you, Topher, Jeff. I hope Wayne's World is a huge success.
We're coming out of Aurora. We're coming out of Aurora. We'll see how it goes. So.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, Coach. Have a great day.
Okay, guys. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye.